Santa Claus sitting in a sauna by the sea, many majestic modern museums, and fantastic filling food. All this can be yours when you choose Helsinki to host the 2017 World Science Fiction Convention. Where else can you enjoy 17 hours of sunlight while exploring an 18th century island sea fortress? The home of Angry Birds and Linux is calling. Come be a part of the excitement as you enjoy all of this and the World Science Fiction Convention in 2017. Make sure to vote Helsinki in 2017. For more information on how to help Helsinki host the World Science Fiction Convention, please visit www.helsinkiin2017.org.
Danger! The emergency destruct system is now activated.
Cake and grief counseling will be available at the conclusion of the test.
She's alive! Alive!
Maybe you should put some shorts on or something if you want to keep fighting evil today.
Why not just put a stake through her heart?
She's not a vampire.
Well, you'd be surprised how many things that'll kill.
We are now seeing the beginnings of another stage of human evolution.
At last, we can retire and give up this life of crime.
You and your training wheels.
Hailing frequencies are open.
Hello, sweetie.
Commencing countdown. T-5-4-3-2-1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show.
Torch's Cinema. The postman, he delivers for you.
I'm Sean.
I'm Julia.
I'm Mike.
I'm Paul.
And I'm Jen.
And we're here, obviously, to talk about The Postman for Torture Cinema. This is another one of our special editions. It is Mike's childhood we are torturing today. So, yay for Mike.
I feel like we're kindred spirits. We both like Kevin Costner movies that are post-apocalyptic.
The Costner-pocalypse will always be with us.
We'll get into that, I guess, in a little bit, but we should probably start off by mentioning what we are all consuming, and then we will have Mike explain why this movie is important to his childhood and how it defined him as a man, and then give us the plot, and then we'll dive into it. So we'll start with you, Julia. What are you drinking?
I'm having an all-American glass of lemonade.
Nice. Yum. It does sound very nice. Mike?
I'm having water because I had a dark and stormy earlier with dinner.
What the hell is a dark and stormy?
It is dark rum and ginger beer, which go together in a very flavorful combination. I first discovered them when I was at Clarion West, so I think of my fellow writer peeps when I drink them.
Excellent, excellent. Paul, what about you?
Like Mike, I'm having hydrogen monoxide.
Why don't you just call it water?
Pure hydro is what you want to call that.
Yeah, call it pure hydro. That's what you should call it from now on, Paul.
Pure hydro.
Well, only when we're discussing Kevin Costner movies.
Yeah, fair enough. Obviously.
Fair enough. Jen, what about you?
I am drinking a delicious goza.
What?
I'm not actually sure that's how you pronounce it. It's a sour beer.
Oh, a goza.
Yes.
Is it like German or something?
It's German. Yeah, it's like a sour alambic beer. I like them, but they're not to everybody's taste.
They're delicious.
Excellent. So
it's like drinking beer lemonade.
Ooh, okay. I might like. Do you think I like that, Jen?
I have no idea. You don't like anything good.
So probably not. Whiskey sours? I like those.
You don't like Waterworld.
So what are you drinking, Sean?
So I seem to be the only one that has invented a cocktail specifically for this movie. But it comes with a story. So I was at the gym and I decided I should make something that's specific for this. So I thought I would come up with a drink called a turpentine, which would just be whatever alcohol I had in my freezer and fridge mixed into one drink. But then I thought my liver probably would not like that. And that I might die given that some of the alcohol in my fridge probably doesn't blend. So I went with a different thing, and I came up with the Postman Mule.
Because as a kick?
So, if those who know what a Russian Mule is, does everyone know what a Russian Mule is? Okay, Russian Mule is vodka, some kind of ginger beer, usually spicy, although that was a little hard for me to find, and then lemon. So like a lime or a little bit of lemon juice, something like that, and that's basically a Russian Mule. I switched it up. Instead of lemon, I took out some grape juice and mixed that in, so it gave it that nice neon purple color. And now I have the Postman Mule. And it is actually surprisingly decent. So,
I'll take your word for it.
It's a little fruity. It's pretty nice. And my liver is happy that I did not mix fire whiskey, red Moscato, Kraken rum, whatever's left of my Tuscany lemonade vodka, and peppermint schnapps.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure I would just die if I had drank that.
And not from the alcohol poisoning, but from the fact that it tastes terrible.
Yeah, oh, and I have Kahlua, too, so that would have to go in there. Yeah, it would have been just
Gainesville iced tea.
No, it would be called the turpentine, Paul. It's the turpentine. It's have just you never... whatever you got in your fridge.
All right, yeah. So there's a movie.
There's a movie. So, Mike, this is a movie from your childhood, so if you wouldn't mind telling us a little bit about why you picked this movie and why you remember it from your childhood, and then describe the movie to us.
Sure. So The Postman is the movie that I could come up with that when Sean asked me, like, hey, pick a movie from your childhood that's objectively terrible, according to the objectivity of IMDb. And I threw out a good half dozen movies, and Sean was like, nope, 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 nope. Because apparently many of the films that I like as a kid and could think of are liked enough by enough other people. But The Postman has a 5.9 on IMDb because, with the hindsight of being an adult, most adults think it wasn't that good. And so that it's a movie that, as a kid, I really, really liked because of the kind of hopeful post-apocalyptic element that I think maybe some of us will get to talk about. And that made it stand out because so many apocalypses of children of the 80s were pretty scorched earthy, and there was not a whole lot of hope. You know, your other options for hope in a post-apocalypse were perhaps you will be saved by Arnold Schwarzenegger as a cyborg. So there you go.
That's not a bad way to be saved.
I know, right?
I mean, you know, he was kind of hot back in those days, you know.
Yep. All right, so shall I do a summary?
Do tell us what this movie is about, if you can summarize it without taking 10 minutes.
All right, so... Jen just chatted that Waterworld has a higher IMDb rating than...
The Postman.
I guess than The Postman. So The Postman is a post-apocalyptic film starring Kevin Costner, based on a novel by David Brin. And it is a movie that feels like it is adapted from a novel, in that it has a lot of, it could be described as like a five-act play. So we join the postman and his buddy, a mule, as they wander the actually not too devastated post-apocalyptic landscape and play around in various things. So that we have the postman kind of jumping up and down on a diving board from a swimming pool, even though there's no water around because all the water's gone away. And we get inclinations that various apocalypse-y things have happened, that big technology has gone away. And the postman goes to a town, and he performs Shakespeare with his mule, which is kind of fun. And then he gets captured and is forced into like a misogynistic rape culture army led by a dude who is the successor to a dude who's Nathan Holm, who is a farmer who probably helped bring about the apocalypse, or took advantage of it after the apocalypse happened. But anyway, they're bad people. There was lots of white supremacy. Yes, thank you, Jen. And so, like, being very critical of the racial purity of everybody. So then the postman escapes and becomes the postman because he finds refuge in a, like, the car van of a
mail truck
in a mail truck, and then takes the mail delivery guy or woman's clothes and the mail and goes to the next town and presents himself as a postman. And because this film is ultimately about building community and hope, everyone is like, the postman, we're really intrigued. And because he had a letter for somebody, he gets to come in, and this creates the beginning of an elaborate lie which will spin out over the course of the rest of the film. So he's the postman, and then he goes somewhere else, and then there's also Olivia Williams as a woman, as a married woman who whose husband can't, like, is infertile, they think. So they want the postman to impregnate her. And then the film continues to go on and on and on. And I would happily tag out to someone else to continue the summary.
I can finish this. I feel like I feel like you've been giving us a very detailed scene by scene synopsis. But actually what happens here is that Kevin Costner tells them he's the postman. They're all excited about this, except for some people who are skeptical. He finds himself caught in this line, having to perpetuate it, and makes a teenage boy, Ford Lincoln Mercury, his deputy post person. And then ultimately gets captured again by the survivalist army, who also kidnaps the woman that he's impregnated. And she ends up saving him. And then they escape. And when they have finished riding out the long winter in a cabin in the mountains, secluded away from everyone else, they discover that the teenage postman has made a bunch of teenage postperson army people out there to rebuild the postal service. And then everything comes to a head when the young post people have a war with the survivalists, and ultimately Kevin Costner has to stop it by challenging the lead survivalist and taking over the survivalist army and then rebuilding society.
By invoking Law 7.
By invoking Law 7.
Yeah, because there are only 8 laws in our feudalistic fascist state. Because that's how you run a government.
Also, Tom Petty has a pretty sizable cameo.
True. Oh, okay. Just be quiet. Okay, well, we should probably then get into our likes and dislikes. So we're going to start with you, Julia, with your first like.
My first like is that this movie is so much better than Waterworld. It's so much better than Waterworld. It blows it out of the water. Yeah, I said it. No, because on so many different axes, it's got a much better narrative flow. A part of that is that it is adapted from a novel, I'm sure. It's also just like really, it's got better music that as far as like actually fitting in with what's happening on screen, there aren't jarring moments where the music is doing something completely different from what's happening on screen. And it's got like actual multiple women. I'm still not clear on whether it passes the Bechdel test, but it sure has a lot of actual female characters who do things. So, all in all, I was like, wow, this movie, way better than Waterworld. Sorry, Jen.
I disagree with the first 3 points, but that last one, I have to concede. There are more women. They are slightly more badass.
So, fun fact, this film is technically based on a David Brin novel. And by technically, I mean it's based on a David Brin novel like a story about elves is based on the Gulf War.
Have you read the novel, Sean?
No, I have not, but I have read stories about the adaptation of this, and Costner apparently basically discarded the entire screenplay, which was more closely adapted from the novel.
I read the novel. Has anyone else here read the novel?
I haven't read the novel, although I did read the Wikipedia summary of the novel's plot, and I have to say, while it diverges a lot from the plot, and I think it does do a lot to make Kevin Costner the lone hero, whereas the novel seems to be more about the ensemble cast. It seems, as far as I could tell, to be a fairly close adaptation as far as these things go, and something that David Brin was actually really happy with.
Paul?
Yes, it misses a bunch of things in the novel and in some things that it removes and some ways that the things go through. It actually is better than the novel in some ways. The novel has a whole plot about a fake AI which isn't fake, and the ending of the novel is a complete and utter mess. By comparison, the ending of this is actually much cleaner and much more streamlined than the muddle that the end of the novel was. I was left. When I read this novel before the movie, I was left disappointed by the novel. In comparison, when I saw the movie, the movie in some ways is better, which really confused me because I can't say that often about novel movie versus novel adaptations.
Okay.
It's a matter of the novel's ensemble cast. I mean, things get wind up by the protagonists of the ensemble cast really get deprotagonized in the ending. Whereas in this movie, Kevin Costner, however reluctant, and we'll probably going to talk about this, actually finally rises up and does stuff at the end. Whereas the novel, things kind of fizzle out, and it's kind of like almost Deus Ex Machina in some ways. So
interesting.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, and you're right, because Costner's character does actually take action in
right,
the end.
Right, which is a stronger ending than the novel. Sorry, David.
Yeah.
Bryn, if he's ever listened to this.
Well, if so, he'll probably kill you, so.
Probably.
But he's in a mountain cabin right now, being hunted by zombies, so it's all good. Well, why don't we jump to you, Mike, your next like. Or your first like.
Yeah, so rewatching this film, because I don't know if I'd seen it between when the movie came out and earlier this week, the thing I was really struck by in this viewing was how much I really like Ford Lincoln Mercury, the young assistant postman who, by himself, for the most part, creates a multi-state jurisdictional governmental organization with at least enough like military and or like outdoorsy training for everyone to be able to navigate the system, and taking this promise from the Costner character and making it a reality, even though he was lying just as much along a different axis as the Costner character was. And like, to go into full spoilers, I really appreciate that he actually gets to get to the end and doesn't get the like person of color sacrificed so that the main character can do the thing kind of setup. So I really, really like Ford Lincoln Mercury and would have been very interested to see the film from his perspective all the way through instead of Costner's.
I completely agree with you on all counts.
100,000,000%.
Yeah, I mean, Costner comes up with this fake idea and really just to get himself a bowl of soup, but Ford Lincoln Mercury inculcates it, believes it, and he executes it. He makes a lot of the plot happen because of what he builds.
Yeah, and he is kind of the main agent of what I feel like is the film's push toward how you put a community back together, how you bring people back together after they've been broken apart, which is a tale type I'm very interested in post-collapse storytelling.
I don't disagree on any count, because I actually really love Ford Lincoln Mercury, even though he names himself after a bunch of cars. It's also still kind of cool. And he does willingly and enthusiastically become a postman, presumably aware that like his life is almost gonna, he's like forfeiting his life because he's gonna die. So,
but he doesn't.
He doesn't, but he almost does. I mean, he essentially should die that moment. We're spoiling everything, so it doesn't matter, right? There's a moment where he almost gets killed, and then Bethlehem decides, no, it'll never be over because there's this random postman from the Republic of California.
That was one of two moments that I teared up a little bit.
Oh, really?
When he picks the whole, when they turn to each other and shake each other's hands, that moment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That was, okay. There's two strong moments that are so contrived, it's kind of ridiculous, but they still somehow work.
Well, a lot of it is because this movie is a tad jingoistic.
Rah-rah America.
And I don't know, I may America. Shut up, because that may come up later, so I'll shut up. But, well, in any case, why don't we jump to you, Paul, for your first
like. Okay, my first like is Will Patton's General Bethlehem. Hell yes. I appreciate a good villain. A good villain will make a movie, and General Bethlehem is a good villain. He's multi-sided, he's complicated, he has ideas, he's not just a single brute. He quotes Shakespeare. I loved, it's corny as hell, I love the Shakespeare
nuts.
Duel. Yes, he's nuts.
Well, okay, but to be clear, it's not really a duel. It's Will Patton out-acting Kevin Costner without trying.
Which, I mean, that's really what's happening.
throwing Shakespeare at each other. It's wonderful. It's so bizarre and over the top. And what the hell is it doing in this movie? But it's so wonderful. And he has an artistic bent, even though Kevin Costner mocks it later on. He tries to paint. He reads, although he burns books. He's a war leader, although he was once just sold copiers and has dreams of dominion. I liked him a lot, and he also understands that he's in a story and he's going to go through that story. The whole scene we talked about with him going to kill Ford, Lincoln, Mercury, and the strange postman from California, although California wasn't part of this original republic, which really confused me the first time I saw this years ago. Like, what the heck? So, Bethlehem understands he can't fight a ghost. He understands that's a bad story. He's a fully fledged, interesting character who out-acts Kevin Costner every moment he's on the screen. I liked him a lot. I was saying this to Elliot today, Bardard, who's been talking about the book. I can appreciate an antagonist because I'm a GM and I run lots of antagonists. He's an antagonist that just commands my attention when I watch the movie. So yeah, go General Bethlehem.
I really love Will Patton. That was going to be one of my likes, so I'm glad that you brought it up, Paul, because Will Patton in this is, like, this is the best role in his career. Which is really sad, because it's the one movie that everyone frickin' hates. But,
and killed a lot of careers in the process.
Well, it killed, well, let's be honest, Tom Petty's career was already dead, but, you know. But he's just, he's evil, but for some reason really charismatic.
Yeah.
Like, I like watching him on screen. Like, I just want him to, like, give some of his Will Patton Bethlehem wisdom to me, even though I know it's going to be evil. Like, he reads from self-help books.
Yeah.
For Christ's sake. Like, instead of, like, you know, Sun Tzu or whatever, like, he's like, nah, I'm going to read from a self-help book. Well, because it's Holm, but, you know, so he's a Holmist, but whatever. And he's not a very, he's smart in the way that fascists are smart, I guess.
He understands how to leverage his charisma to get what he wants.
Yeah, and he's harsh. He's a hardcore dude.
He is a hardcore dude.
He don't mind killing nobody.
It's necessary for plot purposes. But the only thing I didn't like is that I would have thought after the Shakespeare duel and everything else he had with him, the fact that it takes so long for him to recognize Kevin Costner when he meets him again felt a little false to me.
It felt really false because, as Sean just said, he otherwise is a relatively smart villain in terms of constructing his, mythos. That moment when the guy asks him whether or not to burn, you know, what to do with the volume of Shakespeare, and he says, burn it.
Yeah.
It was a gorgeous... It was probably the best moment to me of the entire movie, and really does show that it's the only character that gets any real development.
Wait. That moment was the best moment in the movie for you?
Yes, because it was the
just get
most
off this podcast.
Intelligent
just
moment of the entire movie.
No, you just, like, I'm sorry, but the best moment of the film is Tom Petty sending Kevin Costner on his carriage ride through the skies. That's
no,
the
no,
best
it's
moment.
Not. It's missing something, but we'll talk about that when that comes up.
Don't even start.
Who's next?
Who's next?
Well, anyway, so maybe Jen, you should go on because there's I don't know. But anyway, yeah, go on.
Is it my turn?
Yes.
Yeah, it's technically your turn.
Oh, well, I like something really awesome in this movie. The horses.
I hate you so much. Like, is the horse union well represented,
so
Jen?
So well represented. They had some beautiful, beautiful horses. Kevin Costner gets to relive his glory days and Dances with Wolves. I mean, it was amazing. Cavalry not actually charging. And the most telling moment that makes the horses the best thing in this movie is when they show the horses of the two armies. And there's a marked difference.
I didn't notice. Explain.
So the survivalists, the Holmes, are all riding black horses or super dark brown, every single one of them. The postal carriers are almost all tan with a couple whites thrown in.
So kind of heavy-handed symbolism, but I get it now.
So heavy-handed, but still pretty, because horses.
I'll agree that the horses actually were pretty cool looking. They had some pretty good riding choreography, and there was especially the one really good shot from above when the postal carriers all went out on their separate routes, and they kind of galloped to one point together, and then you saw them fan out.
Yeah, that was that.
That
is a beautiful scene.
The moments when this harkens back to sort of classic westerns are nice.
Well,
I also Bill, and I was very sad when Bill bit it.
Yeah. Bill the acting horse. Acting mule. Sorry.
He's a mule. Yeah, he's a mule. Get it right.
But yeah,
don't
so
be
the
an
horses,
ass, he's a mule.
That's what I like about that movie.
Horses. Horses are good.
All the pretty horses.
So this actually brings me to one of my likes, because Julia brought up that great scene. And part of what makes that scene so great is that the soundtrack to this is friggin' amazing. It's James Newton Howard, and his soundtrack is just, like, I listen to, so, like, okay, story time. I used to work illegally on a farm when I was a young teen. And I know I worked there illegally because I was paid 10 cents the bucket, and I was not paid a wage. So, and I used to listen on my Walkman to the soundtrack to The Postman and to Star Wars The Phantom Menace, like, nonstop. And so, like, as soon as I turned this movie on, like, I was, like, singing the tunes to The Postman because I recognize all the tunes. And that scene that Julia mentions is one of those beautiful moments because it's really, like, it's vibrant and exciting, and James Newton Howard's score just really enhances that beautiful shot.
Except it was the only time that it actually matched the action on the screen.
Shut up, Jen. You don't know anything about music. You're wrong. Everything about this is correct.
James Newton Howard.
James Newton Howard's score is perfect. It is beautiful. It is wonderful. It is
in a different movie.
Shut up. You're just ruining all the good things in life right now. This movie is not as bad as you want it to be, and you're just trying to get back at me because of Waterworld.
No, it's not as bad as I want it to be. It's exactly as bad as I want it to be. Just as Waterworld is exactly as bad as I want it to be. And I get to like one, but you get to like the other, but it's like impossible for... I'm still the idiot?
Yeah, that's exactly what's happening right now, because...
I'm not getting it.
You just...
Particularly considering that one has a higher IMDb rating, and it's not the one
because
you
IMDb
like.
Because IMDb ratings are
so
relevant.
So I'm more right
They're
than
relevant.
You are. Just admit it.
That's not true. It doesn't make you right. What kind of nonsense is that? That's like, oh, well, like you know, if people rate shit on Amazon, that must be an indicator of it being a good book.
We have to move on.
Moving on to Julia's first dislike. Go, Julia.
Okay, so my first dislike is that this movie is way too long.
Yes.
I think it would have been a much better movie if it came in at 2 hours instead of three. And it goes on and on. And I was actually enjoying it in certain places. Like, I didn't find myself really wishing for it to be over and wishing to get through scenes a lot of the time. It's just that I got to a point where I was very tired and wondering when it was going to end. And then there was still an hour left. And I was like, you know, if this were 2 hours, you could cut out a lot of the things that happened and get straight to the meat of it. And it would be a much better movie.
I had to come home almost early.
Just to watch the movie. Like, I kept, especially in that last hour, just being like, okay, how much longer is this going to go on? Like, how long do I have to sit here? And kind of trying to fidget and move and run in place and play with my cat and just, you know, why isn't this over yet? Which is never a good sign. So, yeah, way too long. And I think that it's the kind of thing that's way too long because Kevin Costner wanted to make an epic about himself. And that's just sad.
So I agree mostly. I don't think it being 2 hours would have worked, but there you could have cut a half hour out of this movie.
You could have cut an hour and a half out of this movie.
I don't think you could cut an hour and a half.
I'm pretty sure that if I cut an hour out of this movie myself, I could make it a much tighter movie. I don't actually have the time and inclination to go through and do film editing to do that, but I'm betting you I could make it a better movie.
Totally agreed.
I mean, it. Yeah, okay. I mean,
not a good movie, but a better movie.
For one thing, I cut the entire America the Beautiful scene.
Oh!
Yes, God, yes. That scene annoys me, and it's... Isn't that one of Kevin Costner's kids?
It might be.
Yes.
Yeah, well, we'll get to that in a minute. So, should we go to Mike?
Mike's versus Like.
Okay, what do I pick here? I think it's... I really dislike how poorly established the wholeness kind of dominance is, and that it takes over two-thirds of the movie before anyone figures out at all how to stand up to them, despite the fact that most of the time the wholeness... Bethlehem shows up by himself with like about 10 dudes at the head to do everything directly, and all it would take is one junior grade sniper to destroy the top of their hierarchy. So I think, and then I'm very confused as to how that 10 of them then always have mortars and like 50 caliber guns trucking around behind them. So they have a lot of gasoline and all of the materials necessary to provision carting around a big chunk of the whole army throughout the region to collect taxes. That's logistically ridiculous. So there's several ways in which, even though it's a really long film, the world building of why the wholeness kind of gangster protectionist racket works. And as Julia said, not to mention how everyone feeds the horses, because horses eat a lot. That's exactly correct. So I think there's a lot of logistic problems in the way that the wholeness are established, but not explained sufficiently in a way, like, because not establishing them well enough means that it's really hard to understand how and in what ways the people could and would resist and why they put up with the wholeness. So that all kind of was really aggravating this time around.
So quick question regarding the horses, because I don't know a lot about horses, but like, can you feed them people?
No, they're
horses are herbivores. They eat grass primarily, and you have to basically make hay for them, which requires like either having a prairie at your disposal all the time, which this did not take place in, or having a significant source of agriculture where you're harvesting grains to feed to your horses. And that takes a lot of land and a lot of people to work the land.
But so like, if you mixed people with
no
grain,
horses do not eat meat.
They don't eat meat. They don't.
Despite the fact that my mother's horse bit me on the breast, they do not eat meat.
Oh my god. Okay, so my theory that they're feeding the washed out recruits is...
No. If they were riding battle pigs, then yes, that would be valid, but no.
There's only battle pigs in The Hobbit, not in here.
That would be cool though, right?
Right.
Well, just like we think bacon is tasty, pigs think humans are tasty and they will eat anything that you feed them.
Yeah, now
that is like one of the classic things that you can do to get rid of a dead body is feed it to the hogs, because they will eat it immediately.
Yeah, isn't that in the movie Hannibal?
Probably. It's in a lot of different things, because pigs will, like, they totally will chow down on humans.
That's disconcerting.
So, should we move on?
Yeah, DePaul.
Okay.
First is like DePaul.
So it ties in a little bit with the pacing of the movie. I think that the whole romance with Abby just adds way too much time to the length of the movie and could really have been pared down or even just excised and not really changed the movie substantially. I mean, we take forever sitting in that cabin. I mean, it's like, okay, are they ever going to get off of that bloody mountain? Oh, the pass is clear. Thank God. And then so we have yet more romantic scenes of she's spurning him, she can't be with him, she's just going to raise the baby on her own. And she really, and I mean, time passes this movie and she never shows. And then suddenly we have a baby. It's like, how does that work? But it just eats up a lot of the narrative. I mean, the first hour of the movie takes a while to get to the mail truck. And it's like, okay. And then things go on. But the narrative momentum of this movie really grinds to a halt when they're sitting there in that cabin. They just sit there, and I understand they're trying to build this relationship, and for once we're not trying to shortcut a relationship, but I think in this case, I mean, it's just adding too long to an already too long movie, and
it literally only exists to give them a period of time that they're away from Ford Lincoln Mercury, and him establishing the postal service.
I mean, you can compress that down a lot and
tons.
show the passage of time, and then suddenly okay, and then things have changed. You don't have to show every minute of those 6 months they're in the mountains, which was what it felt like watching it. I mean, don't get me wrong, Olivia Williams is very pretty. I'm not quite sure of the chemistry between her and Kevin Costner, but yeah, way too long.
Okie dokie.
The time was a major issue for me in terms of there's some areas that it speeds up and then there's other areas that it slows way down. And you're just like, why is this area so slow when it could really be the fast area? And if you had made the fast areas slow, this might have been a better movie.
Yeah, there's a big problem in the film of how time is passing. Because it's not always clear when time is passing. We just kind of have to figure it out. Because time just does. And so sometimes it's so quick. Sometimes it's slow. There is a minor pacing issue. All of you would say it's part of the big problem with the movie. But there is a time problem. And some of it is just... they could, as Paul said, trimming things down. Or... keeping certain pieces but deciding to sacrifice others. Or honestly, you could have, like, as we've already mentioned, right? Like, because everybody loves Ford Lincoln Mercury, why not just skip the whole part where they're in the woods and just show Ford Lincoln Mercury?
That would have been amazing.
For that half hour.
Were I called upon to remake The Postman, I would have it as a cable drama TV series. And then there would be opportunity to unpack all these things and to have maybe a procedural element for a little while, and for it to be a narrative counterexample to The Walking Dead's eternal grimness.
Be like young writers crossed with the 100.
Yep.
I'd really love to see that series where we actually get to see how Ford Lincoln Mercury establishes his postal service. Because when we come back to him, he's done a ton to set that up.
I know.
Okay, everybody, copyright that idea now, because I'm sorry.
Well, Kevin Costner may still own the rights to the Postman.
Oh, you don't need the Postman story. You just do post-apocalyptic and Postman and call it good.
Yeah, you're going to get sued. Come on.
You don't have to call it Postman. Young Writers is basically the Postman, but not post-apocalyptic. Yeah.
Just pick another one of the federal government's programs.
One of them is cool.
Right, food stamps. It'll be a food stamp deliverer.
None of them bring
man.
Us together quite like the postal service.
They deliver for you.
The reconstituted IRS. An HBO drama.
Oh, God, no.
It's like Pony Express meets Social Security. They're like riding around giving federal assistance. It's post-apocalyptic SNAP.
Ma'am, here's your SNAP card.
No, I have many ideas, and I'm going to keep the rest of them to myself so I can solve them.
Seriously? Yeah, definitely stop talking. Because I would watch the crap out of that show.
All right, so who's next?
It's me. Oh. It's me. And I already brought this up. It is the one thing that I hate about this movie, which is that Kevin Costner can't resist putting his fucking kids in everything. So his kids have speaking roles. And in some cases, his kids have not good speaking roles. So, for example, the character named Ponytail.
What? Don't diss.
That is
Do
Kevin
not
Costner's
diss Ponytail.
Daughter. Ponytail has the worst acted line in the whole fucking movie. Even worse than the Shakespeare line when Kevin Costner is trying desperately to be a thespian and can't. She says, right, what Ford did was wrong, but it doesn't help anybody, man. She says this horrible line, and she's awful. And it's partly because Kevin Costner directed this movie, and he doesn't know how to direct anybody worth a snot. I think Will Patton just showed up on set and screamed lines, and Kevin Costner said that was okay.
It worked.
But Kevin Costner's kids appear at least three times in this movie, and the only one of his kids that can actually has acting chops is the one who plays the daughter of Irene Marsh.
The one who sings.
Did she see Sing?
I'm pretty sure that's the girl that starts America is Beautiful, isn't
it? No. No, no, this is his other daughter. He's got like 19 daughters.
Oh, was that Ponytail? No.
No, no, Ponytail is the girl who is the postal worker person.
Oh, okay, right.
She's the one that says that horrible line after all the people die. And then I think it's also his kid who sings America the Beautiful, which is like, why? Why would they even know this stupid song? Why would they know it?
It's only been 15 years since everything fell apart. I mean, everybody has working memory of everything that happened in the 90s.
Except that kid.
She knows whatever parents have taught her.
As evidenced by the fact that they're still playing hacky sack.
They are playing hacky sack. I hate Kevin Costner's kids in this. Why? Just put people who are actors in the roles. That's really simple.
Okay. Let's go to second like, which would be Julia.
Second likes for Julia.
I haven't
go,
done
Julia.
My first dislike.
Yeah, you guys skipped Jen.
We don't care what Jen
I thought
has
you had
to say.
Given it right on top of mine. I'm sorry, Jen.
Oh, I just dislike everything, but. I'm kidding.
Go ahead, Jen.
I was going to save this, but I really, truly dislike the fact that, once again, the white man takes credit for what the black kid does.
Yeah.
Wait, what?
Basically, she's saying that Ford Lincoln Mercury does everything, and then Kevin Costner comes in and gets the credit and the statue.
Yep.
That's fair.
Yeah,
it was majorly problematic, especially considering the fact that the Holmes are portrayed as white supremacists. So the fact that they fed straight back into that sort of racism was really disappointing and infuriating.
Ford Lincoln Mercury wasn't at that last scene at the end, was he?
Yeah, he was.
Yes, he was. Oh, you mean the scene with the statue?
He wasn't.
Scene at the statue.
He's not at the scene with the statue. We don't actually learn what happens to him.
He doesn't even get a freaking
postman.
Statue.
Did we ever learn what the postman's
name
is?
No. He has no name.
Is he just
he's just the postman in the credits.
Why doesn't he ever tell
and
anybody his name?
He also goes by Shakespeare.
Well, he's called Shakespeare in the postman.
He doesn't tell everybody his name because he is an everyman. He's a legend.
I just thought he was been through the desert on a horse with no name. He was going to get out of the rain.
No, he was through
the
desert
other way
on
around.
A mule named Bill.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, that's a fair point, Jen. Thank you. Fair point. So shall we jump to Julia?
Sure. Okay, so my second life actually plays in a lot to that, because I agree with what Jen said. It really bothered me. On the other hand, when I compare this movie to Waterworld, again, I am just amazed at how well minorities and women do in this movie. So, like, I was really worried, especially in the beginning, because the first thing that happens is the Holnesses come to this village and they're like, we're going to take three of your men. And they reject one of them for not being white enough. And they take three, including Kevin Costner. And one of them looks like he's mixed race and might be part of African descent in some way, which I guess the general didn't realize at first. But one of the other soldiers calls it out. Like, I was surprised when they chose that guy to begin with. I was like,
yeah.
Huh, if they're like trying to choose only white people, that's a weird choice. But apparently, like, it was supposed to be.
It reestablishes how insane.
Yeah. So, and so, like, that guy does get killed off pretty quickly. And I was like, man, this is going to be another one of these movies where all the people of color die. And that's just really annoying. And then it made me really happy that Ford Lincoln Mercury had such a really outstanding role and did not die. He just really, like, he stood up to Kevin Costner and he was the soul of the movie.
But
there
were
multiple points where Kevin Costner was just like, this is a terrible idea, because he was just doing it to get food and he didn't want to be responsible for killing a bunch of people. But Ford Lincoln Mercury knew all of the dangers and he was doing it because he wanted with all of his heart to be free of the survivalist warlords and to rebuild a really vital community. And to him, that was worth dying for, and that was worth lying for and building a post office for. And I was like, you know what? That kid is awesome. And he was the soul of the movie, and he was great, and I was so glad that he didn't die. I was also super glad that Abby was perfectly capable of looking after herself. She saved herself and Kevin Costner multiple times, and yep. She was not afraid to do whatever it was, whatever she deemed necessary, even if there were choices that I wouldn't have made to get things going in the direction she wanted. So, like, when the pass was clear, she just burned the cabin down. Which I certainly wouldn't have made that choice, because I would feel like you could probably leave that cabin up in case somebody else needed it. But she did it so that Kevin Costner couldn't stay there. And I was like, well, you know, it's definitely like an assertive choice.
Yeah, and I love his response. He, like, he has nothing to say, but she's really weird.
Yeah, yeah. He says that a lot to her. I did find – well, I will get into that at a later dislike. But anyway – I think that it was great that there were multiple women with speaking roles and active roles, and Abby was the one who clearly had the biggest role, but there were other women doing things, and that made me happy.
Yeah, I love Abby. Abby is, I mean, that moment when she picks that rifle up and she just starts shooting people and like, oh, you hope she's going to get Bethlehem. You know she's not, but God, she almost gets him. And it just really feels good. And then, you know, they have that fun moment with, like, the guy on the horse. And it's like, we're going to go into the wilderness together. And yeah, it was fun. That's good. That's my impression of every Western, basically. Yeah.
Next.
All right, Mike, what do you got for
my
us?
My second, like, is a little bit touched on earlier. I like that it's actually very clear that pre-collapse culture is still around. Because that's how it works. And there are other post-apocalyptic stories, cough, cough, Book of Eli, cough, where somehow in the matter of 1 to 3 decades, everything about the pre-collapse world is forgotten. But in this story, there's like, they have a folk band, like hoedown version of Come and Get Your Love, which is like super cheesy and ridiculous, but is for me, I think exactly the kind of post-collapse recontextualization of contemporary culture that you would have. Like, there are guitars around and people remember songs, and you modify what you had when things fell apart, and you recontextualize them to do what you need something to do. And that scene, while cheesy, I think, was pretty cool, and I liked the way that it used recognizable culture in a different context for kind of a social purpose within that community.
I agree. And it reminded me a lot of in John Scalzi's Lost Colony and Zoe's Tale, where the inhabitants of the planet that kind of get shipwrecked off on the planet without communication with the outside world and no tech working end up kind of doing their own hoedowns where they, since they can't play their MP3s or whatever, they're just like remembering the songs that they liked and performing their own versions.
It reminds me of Reign of Fire with the reenactment of Empire Strikes Back.
Well, I thought that the thing that reminded me of that was when Kevin Costner did his Shakespeare with
yes.
Bill.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I mean, it's kind of like a echo of previous culture kind of reinterpreted for the next generation and carried forward rather than just completely forgotten, like in, say, Book of Eli, where culture seems to be completely gone.
So what was really probably like a, it'll be cheaper to just show 90s stuff because it's the 90s, is somehow an intelligent move.
So can I just say that all of the fun little bits about the music, like the little band singing songs and doing their own versions, is nice. But did anyone notice the song in the credits?
The Amy Grant and Kevin Costner, who should never sing, version of You Didn't Have to Be So Nice.
You Didn't Have to Be So Nice.
Oh, God.
Kevin Costner should never sing.
No, he should never sing. It's terrible. And he just sings a song with Amy freaking Grant, who sounds at every instance like, what am I doing? Why am I in this song? What has happened to my career? Yeah. Yeah, but I agree. I love the, you know, Come and Get Your Love. Like, that rendition is really good. It's on the album, and it's really fun to listen to. So, A plus, Mike. I approve of you.
First time ever.
Is that true? I approve of you all
Mark
the time.
Down the history. Okay, moving on.
Moving on.
All right,
okay,
Paul, go.
I've never been to the Pacific Northwest, but I appreciated what the multi-sided and multi-kind of vistas we see throughout this movie. We get to see the scablands of eastern Oregon. We get to see mountains. We get to see forests. There's some really beautiful scenery here. And some of it is gorgeously shot. I mean, and there's some really, really nice cinematography. Like, we were talking about the horses before. Like, that first scene where we see the wholeness riding into town in a column is, like, nice. And the scene where the postal riders go fanning out, there are some gorgeous shots here. Kevin Costner may be crap as trying to direct people, but at least he knows his landscapes. Dances with Wolves proves that. I mean, Waterworld he doesn't really have anything to work with, but like in Dances with Wolves, he knows how to show off how beautiful the Pacific Northwest is from the scablands of eastern Oregon all the way to the Pacific Coast at the end.
Yeah, Costner's use of wide shots, he's really good at wide shots, especially moving wide shots.
Yeah.
Not so good with people, no. As you note, but, I mean, there's that great scene, right, where right after he's captured, and we see the whole wholeness camp, and that big long shot we see of it kind of flying in, that's a really good shot. And there are other ones like that, as you mentioned, Paul, I don't know what happens when he gets close up on human beings.
He should be doing documentaries of landscapes rather than people.
He would be good in a documentary, except he wouldn't be able to show penguins very well.
No, he wouldn't be able to show penguins. I'm thinking, you know, like showing the natural beauty of Earth. I think he would be awesome at that because he clearly has an eye for it.
Yeah, that's true. I would agree with you there. Yeah, he's got a good eye for shooting locations too, I think. The locations he picks, some of them are just absolutely gorgeous.
He picks some good places to set things. I mean, if it looks good, it feels good. Everything from the tight little mail truck all the way to the towns to the wholeness camp. The wholeness camp looks good. I mean, I like the little island. Which has the movie projector. That's a nice little bit there.
Yeah, I love this bit when he tries to show them Universal Soldier
and they want the Sound of Music. Yes, oh my God, I lost like crap.
Which is then weird because Sound of Music is all about how Nazis are wrong and lack music in their life.
It is really ironic, right?
Yeah, I think it's this indication that Bethlehem's army isn't as gung-ho as Bethlehem would like to think it is.
Which then helps explain how the ending actually functions, because it's like, ah, yes, the general of the racist, misogynistic army has been defeated, and now everything is fine.
Right, because the army is behind him as he thinks it ever was.
It's optimism. What are you talking about?
This is why you need to give me a cable drama series version.
Look, Mike, we're working on it. I just made a phone call.
Yes!
HBO, if you're listening, call Mike Underwood.
No, not HBO. Let's go with Netflix.
Netflix. I could do.
No. This is clearly a CW show.
Yes. No, God no, because yes. They give him $8 to make it, and he'll have to.
Oh my God, no! Wonderful. They're doing. Yeah.
I would totally do a version of that. Well, because it's mostly teenagers.
Yep.
I'm on board.
Thank you.
I could see this as, Rain is a CW show, and that's completely bonkers, but I'm enjoying it. So.
Oh my God, I'm totally addicted to that show.
I'm
but
there
for again, mostly it, teenagers. So, exactly. You know, clearly the CW has but the 100
is literally, this is an iteration of it. Like I said, it's a combination of the 100 and you know, young writers. And that show is wildly successful on CW right now. And Arrow and Flash and
yep. They're doing a lot of really. They're actually up until this most recent pair of shows. CW is doing more interesting science fiction than the Sci-Fi Channel, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair. That is fair.
But anyway, moving on.
So moving on. So Jen, your second and of course your final like.
Oh crap! I forgot. I'm just kidding. It actually totally dovetails into this conversation. So my favorite thing about this movie is the kids in it. And like, I know it's like boo to the acting ability of most of them, but it's really nice to see a film that was made in the 90s when granted is slightly before the major backlash of youth being incapable, but that happens every generation. And yet you still show a film where it's basically the kids taking charge. And doing everything, which was
putting their lives on the line,
which was kind of awesome. And Opie is in it, and he's so adorable when he was a teenager. So,
yeah,
from Sons of Anarchy, nobody gets the reference. Just checking.
No, I know who you're talking about. He's
adorable.
Cute. Was he the same one that was in Remember the Titans?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, he was adorable then too.
At least I think it is. Maybe not. I don't know.
I think it's the same guy. He's the guy who gets paralyzed in Remember the Titans.
Okay, now I need to look that up. But anyway, and that's how they get over like.
Racial differences.
And yeah. Obviously that ties to the Ford Lincoln Mercury, but, you know, he really does have a bright-eyed, optimistic group of youth to back him up, and they're all obviously capable, and it was just nice to see. It obviously pissed me off that the old white dude took all the credit once again, but you know,
yeah,
it's kind of awesome.
I do like that scene right when the sheriff is telling, you know, Ford like you don't do this thing, and Ford's response is like, well, what should I be, right? Like,
yeah,
he's going to do this no matter what this older man is telling
you've
him to
given
do
us a completely crap world, what do you expect me to do?
Yeah. Well, and it's a world where they don't fight back in any way. There's no resistance to what is very obviously oppression. And here's this kid who's like, fuck that noise.
And
we're going to go do something
different.
And the
kid is looking at those adults, those older people who were right at the root cause of all of it.
Yep. Yeah. I do like that part.
It's kind of awesome.
It is kind of awesome. So, well, I guess that leaves it to me. The last like for the postman.
Yep.
There are a lot of things that I really do love about this movie. But I will say that the thing that I really, really, really love, other than Tom Petty, is that this movie is enormously optimistic and it feels really good.
Yep.
And there's not much more I need to say about that. Everybody gets it. It just feels good.
My dislike, but.
Oh, come on. How?
Well, she'll get a chance to explain. Let's focus on the positive part, and then we'll get contrast.
No, she's already ruined it.
No,
she's just taking the life
out of me. No, she hasn't, Sean. You do.
Everybody totally agrees, so.
Except you.
No, I agree. It's a very optimistic movie.
What's wrong with the optimism?
Order operations. Wait. Well, we're a positive, not negative, Sean.
I just want to move on now. I just want to move on because, like, now I need to have a whole, like, no. Let's just move on dislikes. Julia, go.
Okay, so yeah, the thing that I was going to, I started to get into it with my last like, and I was like, no, I gotta stop myself. This is the positive part, is that I did find that it was very upsetting to me, the thing that Jen said earlier about how, like, Ford Lincoln Mercury does everything. He actually, like, stands up to Kevin Costner multiple times and tells him why it's important when Kevin Costner just clearly doesn't get why it's important. And then he doesn't get any of the credit. Kevin Costner is the one who gets the statue, and everybody's like, he's amazing, he's the postman, when really it's Ford Lincoln Mercury who made this all happen. Also, like, Abby... So there's the whole thing with the first point where they have sex, which goes on for way too long. Like, you can tell they apparently had sex all night long, because it felt like all night long having to watch that. And
because it's Kevin Costner's movie.
Well, yeah. And the thing is that, like, at this point, she's married to another guy. And the reason why she's having sex with him is so that she can get a baby, because her husband had the bad mumps and can't reproduce.
Extra but, like, creepy.
In order to show this, she's just like, hey, why don't I seduce you? Instead of like, hey, why don't you give me some of your sperm, like in a turkey baster, because that's a thing people could do. And then she's like, it would be better for me if you closed your eyes. But then, like, they actually kiss on the lips, which is totally unnecessary if the whole point is just to get his sperm. She asks him to dance, and she asks him all the questions, and she's like, so you have healthy sperm, to the best of your knowledge, right? Because I want a baby.
We cannot forget the rule of Pretty Woman.
Yeah. She totally throws the Pretty Woman rule out the window and kisses him on the mouth. But, like, I don't understand why they have to have, like, monkey sex all night long, and why they didn't just, like...
Because you're more likely to get pregnant if you have an orgasm.
So there's that. And I guess, okay, so Kevin Costner in this movie is a much better hero than he is in Waterworld. Like, he's actually someone who is still an anti-hero, but you can kind of sympathize with him, and he doesn't want everyone to die, and, like, you can see where he does things wrong, but you can kind of, you don't think he's a horrible person. He's got some likable aspects to him, so it's, like, possible to actually root for him at all. But he's still not someone I actually care deeply about or want to win. I want Ford Lincoln Mercury to win, and I kind of want Abby to win because she's kind of cool. And I'll kind of put up with Kevin Costner because of that. But I really wish this movie was not about him and was instead about the other people, and that it treated them with a little bit more respect.
So the sex scene, maybe I just read this into it, but I got the impression that, like, he just, like, he couldn't keep it up, and, like, they had to keep trying?
I did not get that impression at all. No. I got the impression that they had sex, okay, like, 5 or 6 times that night.
Well, it just seems like 5 or 6 times would be unnecessary.
Well, they wanted to make sure, for total sure, that she got every little last drop of sperm she could.
That's not how it works.
Yeah.
It's bad reproductive genetics, to be sure.
I just got the impression that maybe I just read into that. I just got the impression that, like, no, he just was having
No,
Bethlehem's the one with the man issues. Yes. Because she actually explicitly points that out. He's like, how do you know it's his? And she's like, because he couldn't do it with me.
Yeah, and with him, it was clear that, like, she says he can't even do it at all. He's completely impotent for reasons.
I got the impression that Kevin Costner in that scene was not that Kevin Costner was supposed to come across as impotent at all.
I didn't get the impression that he was fully impotent, but that this is a man who has.
I just cannot believe in a world where Kevin Costner would direct that scene and star in that scene where he was having trouble getting it on with a hot woman.
Yeah. Julia's right.
Okay. Any other thoughts? Okay. Well, then we will jump to you, Mike.
All right.
Your last dislike.
Where to go? Okay. So I'm gonna kind of add on to some of what Julia and other folks have said, and have my dislike be the postman himself. I get that he's the initial catalyst character, but Ford Lincoln Mercury does so much more of driving the cool parts of the plot. And for a guy who gets by kind of by being slick and doing a good enough job performing Shakespeare to get, you know, room and board, he's a terrible liar. You know, he's incredibly clumsy all the way through creating the postman myth, and the sheriff sees through him, but we're supposed to believe that the sheriff is mostly being really suspicious and that somehow the postman was good enough at the lie that people really wanted to believe it and that that's what they focused on. And mm-hmm. I think that his level of lying was so low in that kind of in that scene and in those experiences that it really undermined my ability to buy that. Ford Lincoln Mercury is so possessed of excitement and belief in the goals and the ideals of the postman that the way that he lies is incredibly convincing by comparison. So Ford Lincoln Mercury struck me as far more charismatic throughout the film, which then extra underlines the annoyance of why it all ends up being about the postman character.
And yet, of course, it's the postman that shows Ford Lincoln Mercury the right way right there at the end.
Yeah, and also this is like a really small nitpick, but there's that scene where he like gallops past the kid who's like hoping to have a letter out. And like, I don't understand why he then gallops super far away before like realizing there's a kid back there and coming back, and then can't just like come back and get it, but has to come back galloping in the opposite direction and picking it up without stopping. Like, what was his end game there? Did he gallop back to town?
No, he must have turned around. No,
he had to have turned around. Just turned around. Why would you do that?
Yeah.
Because
about scenes that I would cut to make this movie shorter.
So many, yes.
Well, okay. So I guess what my question for you, Mike, is you would not believe that a man named Howard or Richard Starkey would live in the Metrodome in Minneapolis.
I think that the people of Pineview probably would have had a fair amount of experience dealing with bullshitters. And I don't believe, like, based on what I actually saw, I don't buy that as many people would have bought into the postman's story as did.
It's only been 20 years. And
interesting evasion of the question.
It's only been 15 years. I think that we have to give the townspeople leeway because what they really want is to believe in the myth. I mean, they don't necessarily want to believe him. They want to believe that the government's back because they really want that hope. So they're willing to overlook any signs that he's probably lying.
Yeah, at least as much of my dislike is disappointment in that character, because I would have bought him as being a better liar based on the fact that he got by performing Shakespeare.
Yeah, and I think we're supposed to find him ambiguous. We're supposed to see, like, we're supposed to see him wavering about, you know, whether he's actually going to keep delivering mail. And, like, he does end up doing it, and it's partly just because he realizes that gives him a cushy position. But we're also supposed to kind of, like, buy into that as his character redemption arc. And I found it very hard to buy into.
Hmm.
Mostly because he didn't actually, like, any time it came down to it, he'd be like, oh no, this is actually a terrible idea.
I got the impression he was better at pretending to be a postman than at doing Shakespeare.
That's fair.
But that's not a great leap.
Low bar.
Given how bad his Shakespeare is.
Low bar.
Fair enough. Well, all right, Paul, why don't you jump
in? Okay, my second and final dislike is, it ties into some of the stuff we talked about earlier about the world building and just how ill-conceived some of these ideas are. Okay, so we've had a series of disasters. So it's been 15 years. We've had the rise of 90s-style militia groups basically topple the government. They talk about the Battle of Georgetown at one point. But we're left with a bunch of scattered communities that remember the past, but the weird, it just seems they haven't thought some of the ideas through, because we get to Bridge City and we meet the Vietnam vet who's on the CB radio, and he says he's listens every day and never hears a thing. And that just is like, no, absolutely not. You can't be the only person in the whole Western U.S. and Canada to have a CB radio. That's just not possible. I mean, if you have it, other people have it. We've seen the Holiness have technology. Other enclaves clearly do. It's a really stupid bit. And not to mention, if civilization is not that far back, then yeah, there's no way that in the flash forward it's ever going to get back to anything approaching normal in only 20 years. It's going to take much longer. So it just didn't. And if there's CB radios, then of course the postman's life falls apart immediately because somebody's going to be CBing out of Iowa and just like, oh, there's no President Starkey. Who the hell is all he talking about? The movie doesn't consider some of the what the apocalypse would actually be like and what civilization afterwards would be like. It's like the thing with the horses. And how do you feed that army? You can't. The Holiness are just not equipped to support themselves as they are depicted. The horses need too much pasture. The people need too much food. They're using too much resources to get that. It's no.
How did two Academy Award winners manage to write this screenplay?
Well, a
lot of alcohol.
Just not thinking through the implications and of anything. And it's like you're the only guy with a CB radio. You're the only Vietnam vet left. Yeah, no. And yet this community, this Bridge City has enough. They have electricity, so they're the only polity with electricity. And yet the Holiness have tons of gasoline. Where the hell did they get the gasoline? Do you all realize that gasoline is volatile, right? It doesn't last. If we stop making gasoline, it would, unless it's in a sealed container, the supply of gasoline is finite, right? You all know this, right? It's basic chemistry. So where the hell are they getting the gasoline? They're not fracking it from anywhere. Like Escape, at least Escape from New York. Brain is actually making it out of oil. Now I can buy. Hooray! The Escape from New York thought of something that this movie couldn't think of. Where do you get gasoline from? Oh, you make it. You have to make more. Fine.
We don't know where he gets it from. We don't have any clue.
It just no. Yeah, but the movie's world just does not stand up for me. It falls apart too easily. It really frustrates me.
I don't think it actually falls apart that much.
We disagree, Sean.
We do disagree, but that's because you need everything explained.
No, I just need a more convincing world. I came to science fiction and fantasy through world building first, and if the world building doesn't hold up, I see it.
Look, for all you know, on the other side of that Holiness compound is a wide pasture where all their horses graze and frolic and do what horses do when people aren't
pictures
around.
Or it didn't happen.
Okie dokie. Well, good luck with that.
Moving on.
Jen.
My turn already?
Yep.
Yes,
so,
it is.
My main dislike of this film, kind of touched on it a couple times, it has to do with the time dilation to an extent. I hate how overwrought everything in this movie is. The direction is just as bad as the screenplay, if not worse, obviously. The time dilation is occurring because he's like trying to make slightly dramatic moments into uber dramatic moments. Hence why you have a 10-minute scene where he's riding past a kid holding up a letter, and then writing back and forth, and
it's 2 minutes long. Come on.
Hence why you have a ridiculously again long wrestling scene there at the end with some of the worst wrestling I've ever seen. But you know,
fuck, you just took my dislike. Damn it.
With nice joyful music too, which was weird to listen to.
That was my ultimate tagline. 170 minutes to see Kevin Costner and Will Pass and roll in the dirt.
Yeah, it was. Thanks you know, for taking that even one the from moments me, that I Thank said, you know, had me tear up because that the horse scene and the kid with the letter, I totally teared up because it worked. Because it was like so America, so United States Postal Service, and I believed in everything in that moment. So yes, it worked, but it didn't require 10 minutes of build up to get there. And then the scene, I mean, honestly, the scene with the kids when they're, you know, saying, you know, it's an honor to meet you. That was cool. That was probably the least overwrought of all the overwrought scenes. The sex scene, horrible, but so dramatic. The scene where he rides down the cable because Tom Petty has the awesomest toys. 10 minutes of just like, oh my God, why? Couldn't you have just shown this movie? Because this would have been a cool movie. And it's just, you know, it's just so contrived and predictable, and it's so deliberate in its we're trying to do epic things that it just drove me insane. Waterworld at least didn't have any sort of, I don't know, delusions of grandeur.
Overwrought? Are you fucking kidding me right now?
I just want to remind you of Kevin Costner being really, really upset that someone used his crayons.
That was amazing.
Oh, shut up.
That was hilarious. But it wasn't overly dramatic. It was just, it was the character being overly dramatic, but it wasn't like the entire direction of the scene over dramatic.
What about the whole scene with Dennis Hopper giving his speech and then they pull out the oars on the giant steel ship?
Hilarious.
Are you fucking kidding me right now?
And they're not even trying to make it dramatic.
She's pointing out that the movie, The Postman, and this is part of why I think it works as optimistic, is because it's very sincere in its drama. Whereas in Waterworld, it tries to be funny, I guess.
Yeah, it didn't know what it was doing.
It doesn't really work in Waterworld, but it also, I think, comes off as schmaltzy in The Postman, and that is certainly something that Siskel and Ebert both found very, very tasteless.
Yeah, it's very sentimental. They didn't like the sentimentality.
As they shouldn't.
Also, I think it's awful. Called, what is the phrase they used?
Jingoistic?
Mawkish jingoism.
Yeah, yes. It is very...
Yeah, Stephen Holden in the New York Times.
There are multiple points. I mean, with America the Beautiful and the whole thing about burning the flag and the U.S. government being the thing that people most want and all of that stuff. It is very jingoistic.
Yeah, it's sort of reasserting democracy. We got to have American democracy, and that's the way to the future. Because our other option are apparently just, like, getting beat by wholeness.
Well, Richard Starkey's whole campaign is apparently the It Gets Better campaign.
Yeah.
It gets better.
So this movie is actually ahead of its time.
Things get better. Things are getting better. Things are getting better all
Stuff's
the time.
Stuff's getting better.
It's like,
Stuff's getting better. Stuff's getting better.
It's like the worst campaign slogan ever.
Well, what do you expect from someone named Richard Starkey who lives in Minnesota? Yeah,
he's from Maine originally.
No, that's not. He's from Maine.
He's from Maine.
So I can't even mock my adopted.
I expect something about like lobster or something in the title. You know, give me some flavor.
No, instead in Portugal you get a relatively tasteless hot dish.
So apparently in the novel, the character who is Kevin Costner in this movie has a name and is some sort of student from the University of Minnesota who studied Shakespeare and drama. And so his kind of wandering around and reciting Shakespeare makes sense in that context. And also, like, he's not a professional actor. He's just some dude who studied Shakespeare. And also he's from Minnesota. So that's where the lie that the president lives in Minneapolis comes from. And I'm like, oh, that makes a lot of sense, which didn't make as much sense in this movie, but okay.
Yeah, that's a missing detail for sure. Yeah.
Because like the beginning of this movie, there's so much in the first act where he does Shakespeare stuff, and then random people will be like, that's Shakespeare. And I'm just like, yeah, I'm like, it's only been 15 years since like whatever happened, and you all still presumably have books and plays.
All the Shakespeare professors died.
Well, I get the impression that Bethlehem shows up at these towns and like takes all their shit and burns it.
And there was a 3-year winter, so I could see a lot of books being burnt for kindling.
Yeah, that's a possibility. And let's be honest, the first books people are going to burn are the Shakespeare and Tax Law.
Well, wait a minute. That's your day
after
tomorrow.
First thing
we
do, we burn
tomorrow.
All the Shakespeare?
I mean, the first thing I'd
no,
burn
that
would
comes
be the
after
phone
tax
book,
law.
Because that's not going to be useful.
Who has a phone book anymore?
Well, it's the 90s when this all happens. Everybody has a phone book.
That's a fair point. That's a fair point.
The movie that is so 90s. So homage to the 90s.
I love it. He has the TV guide in that scene when he's at the gas station and he's like fake imagining he's watching.
Well, it's not fake imagining. I think he's. I mean, we get hints for a whole section and then it's dropped. And I almost had this as a dislike that he's kind of lost.
He's hallucinating.
He hallucinates a lot. I mean, there's a whole bunch of reflections, sounds, and so.
Yeah,
I mean, it's clearly he's going a little around the bend, and then it miraculously all disappears. Maybe it's the healing love of Olivia Williams. I don't know.
No, it's
found water.
This is what happens. No, I think it's because he ends up back among people, and all of those illusions just kind of fall away because people suck.
Yeah, I think that would be too intelligent for this movie.
Well, look, I can't explain how this movie is as brilliant as it is. It just is. So should I go to my last dislike since you've already ruined it,
yes,
Jen?
Yes, please do.
Okay, so, you know, we know that this confrontation between Bethlehem and Kevin Costner is going to show up, and it's going to come, and maybe it's just me being spoiled by, you know, 15 years of really great action scenes, but... For the same reason that I don't like watching MMA fights, and I don't like watching the fight scene at the end of this movie. Because, honestly, 3 minutes of dudes, like, hugging each other on the ground is the least interesting fighting in the world.
Yeah.
So would it have been better if first they stripped naked and rubbed themselves in oil?
Yes. Because at least they would have been slippery and it would have been kind of fun watching them flop around on the ground like fish. But even that for 3 minutes is too much.
I was thinking sort of in the classical Greek wrestling style.
Oh,
and Kratos.
Just throw some punches, damn it. Like, come on.
How about some Star Trek Mock Time fight music? Would that have made it better?
Yep. You get that double axe handle swing. It's big business.
I expect Sousa marches.
Yeah.
Oh, God. No.
Yeah, I think that definitely would have been a much better score to that scene.
Yeah.
All right, so...
That would make that scene so much more interesting, though. It was Philip Sousa marches.
We've proven
like,
that
really.
If the apocalypse does happen, Sean will remember Philip Sousa marches for us.
It's good to know.
Every fight is going to have that theme.
That's my cleaning
I'm gonna
music.
I'm going to keep a tuba just for that.
That is a question, though. Like, so presumably, I get the whole burning books, whatever, but you don't burn brass instruments, so why were there not more marching bands in this movie?
I know, Mad Max has spoiled me on the lack of good musical accompaniment for armies.
Right?
Yeah!
Duke Warrior is amazing.
I mean, at the very least, they should have had, like a horn or something, like... A drum corps or, like, one of those, like, long-ass horns in the military.
You've got two cavalries and tubas and French horns and flutes.
Oh, my God. Can you imagine if the end fight scene, instead of them just riding at each other
actual,
on horseback and then not
cavalry
fighting,
battle?
They ride at each other with, like, different horn instruments and they just, like... Like, one team is, like, the tuba team, and they just, like, play it really loud, and they just go at each other until they can't hear anymore, and whoever falls off the horses from being too dizzy
loses. Battle of the band for America.
Yeah.
Art Crawl?
I'd watch that.
Art Crawl!
Art Crawl! So I hate the fight scene. It's in slow, and this is the problem that Jen, you mentioned too, right? That scene with the kid, he shoots it in slow motion, but like, for like the whole trip, like he rides a whole mile in slow motion.
Yeah, like he rides really far away.
Like,
why are you even stopping? What made you realize there was a kid back there? Because you clearly didn't notice it ages ago.
Oh my God, terrible.
Well, it's because it's Kevin Costner's son. He's got like son psyche or something. But it's he indulges in this, like, I hate slow-mo fight stuff and overuse of slow-mo. Like, slow-mo is, it's just dead. Just kill it. And that fight scene is all in slow-mo. And, like, they make these sound effects for, like, when they, like, push out of the grapple. And it's like, whoosh! And you're like, that's supposed to be exciting. But it's like, why? Because he, like, kicked up in the air? Like, what's going on right now? And then there's, like, the moment when, like, Bethlehem's spitting on Kevin Costner's face, which is kind of amusing. I guess, actually, I like that part, because I feel like poor Will Patton has been put into this situation, and he wanted to have a fist fight, or a sword fight, or something,
demeaned.
And what he got was he had to hug Kevin Costner for 3 days.
Yeah. Nope.
Which,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not so fun.
I think it's about time for us to grade this thing.
I think it is about time for us to grade this thing, y'all. So, Julia, hit me with it.
So, I actually enjoyed this a lot better than I enjoyed a lot of different things we watched for torture cinema, and it's still an hour too long, and it still has its flaws, but it's way better than Waterworld. And at the risk of having all of nerddom yell at me, I think it's actually also better than Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, which I also recently watched and did not hold up, alas, even though, like, Alan Rickman is in it and everything.
I'll cut your heart out with a spoon! But,
yeah, so I kind of have to give this, I think I'm going to have to give it a C+, because it's actually, like, it's got its good points going for it.
All right, fair enough. Jen, do you know why they need to cut the heart out with a spoon? Because it'll hurt more, obviously.
Yes,
come on,
I'm
now.
Sorry.
Yeah, you need to know your movies, Mike.
I do.
What about you?
I was looking for it. Sorry.
I am going to give this movie an optimistic C+, because a C+ is a passing grade that lets you be able to move on and have a future, and I think the film barely scrapes that by.
Okay, fair enough, Paul.
This movie is a big improvement over Waterworld. It is an hour too long and really, really needs to be trimmed, and the world building really needs to be thought through. On the other hand, it has some nice vistas, and for it being schmaltzy, the positivism of a post-apocalyptic society is not something you get that often. And it tries. The movie tries hard, and I really like Ford Weekly Mercury, and he should have had a statue, goddammit. So we get the C+.
All right, fair enough. Jen?
I don't know.
I'm going to hate you when you answer this.
I don't feel really one way or the other about this movie. It's kind of a non-movie.
Gotta give a number.
Is.
What?
So, all I can do is just give it a C, because that's just, you know, not good, it's not bad, it just is. For 3 hours.
Okay. And you, Sean?
You know, I love this movie. It's flawed. It's got some things I really dislike. I wish I could easily skip over every time Kevin Costner's kids have to act, but I can't. But every time I see Tom Petty show up, and he's like just this kooky old dude, and is probably smoking some doobie, and, you know... Well, the Vietnam guy is definitely smoking doobie. I don't know where he gets it from. There must be like a marijuana factory.
There we go. There we go with the world building problem again. Where is he getting his marijuana?
Well, that just grows.
Maybe he had a stash
sure
from
Vietnam.
Yeah, that grows
plentifully
wild.
Up there in the Pacific Northwest. I don't think that's a problem.
Okay.
Yeah, that's fair.
He's probably not having problems getting some doobie. Yeah. You know, there's just lots of things I really love about this movie. And every time I watch it, I get a little teary-eyed sometimes. Because there are just some beautiful moments, and I just love it. So it is an A minus for me.
Well then.
Wow. Well, so I would just like to say that there is a piece of fan fiction on Archive of Our Own about this movie that is specifically about the time when Kevin Costner and Abby are in the cabin, but from the point of view of Ponytail and about Ford Lincoln Mercury establishing the Postal Service. So awesome. That is called She Wrote Upon It by Damkiana on Archive of Our Own. And you can totally, if you just go to Archive of Our Own and search for Ford Lincoln Mercury, it is the only result.
I have found it.
Also, I will put a link in the show notes.
So the average for the movie almost hits a B minus.
If that's because of Sean's okay. A minus.
Yep.
Yeah, because I love this movie and it's totally legit that I love it. So there you go. So that's Torture Cinema, The Postman. Not the worst movie we've ever watched, but give it time, y'all. We'll get there.
Until again. Next time.
Until next time. So if you want to support us on Patreon, you can go to patreon.com/skiffyandfanny. If you want to see us suffer some more through some more bad movies, that's a good way to help out with that. So that note, awkward ending.
Bye, all.
Stay frosty.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
This is Ripley, last survivor of the Nostromo. Signing off.